Welcome to the first, the very first, Davis Arts Gallery poetry series. And I'm very pleased to have Andy Jones, County Post, joining us here today, two poets laureate from different areas. There's a few things I want to tell you about. There's some wonderful programs here at the Arts Center. And first of all, the website is Davis Arts Center, arts with an S. You have to spell things right on the internet. DavisArtsCenter.org. And we have classes here in theater, ceramics, culinary arts, dance, drama, painting and drawing, mixed media, music, tech arts. Right over here on the edge of the stage are some catalogs for stuff going on. Please grab one. And again, the website is DavisArtsGallery.org. Okay. The first poet today, Dr. Andy Jones, known affectionately around Yolo County as just Dr. Andy. After his many years here, been teaching at UCD since 1990. Is that when you moved here, Andy?
That's right, 1990.
That's a pretty good while back. And teaching at UCD, he's also been hosting Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on Radio KDVS, Radio Free Davis, as we'd like to say. He's published books of poetry, Splitstock, Where's Juki, In the Almond Orchard. He has a new book of, trivia is the wrong word to use. It's
pub quizzes. Trivia for smart people.
Yes, trivia. Oh, and it's just very nicely bound and put together, too. The books on the table here are all for sale. Connie has some, too. Please welcome, if you would, Dr. Andy.
Thank you, James. I'm situating myself in front of the absent microphone here. I'll have to use my full Shakespearean powers so that you all can hear me, but I agreed that the acoustics are wonderful in the Davis Arts Center. I feel honored to be able to inaugurate this new reading series and pleased that Connie Post could travel at some distance to join us this afternoon. For our reading, and I'm just going to keep track of the time. You know, when you give a poetry reading, if you're me, one of your first questions is, who's going to be there and what do they want? And some of you have heard some of my poems previously, but I think that James Lee Job has the strongest recent attendance at the Poetry Night reading series, and he's hosted me at another venue. So at some point you think, how do I make sure not to bore people? At previous readings, it was Allegra Silberstein who I had to be careful not to bore, because she attends just about everything that I've done, which I've appreciated. So I've included a few poems today that I thought James would appreciate, or he hasn't heard them, or they have some rock and roll in them. And we've got some seats up front if you dare. Okay, but meanwhile, I thought we would march through four books of poetry that I've written, excerpts thereof, and then hear some new poems. One thing I remember when from a concert I once ushered, that when the Rolling Stones say, and we've got a new song to play for you all, that's when everyone goes to get a beer. Because they want to hear, like, the old favorites, right? The songs that they had written 40 years previously, rather than their new stuff. But the poet, the musician, is often more excited about the most recent composition. So I'm excited to get to those. But very responsibly, I'm going to share with you some poems from my previous books. This is my first book of poetry. It's called Splitstock. It was co-authored with Brad Henderson, who is a local poet and musician. And it is richly illustrated and overpriced. But but I brought one copy, and I'll read one of my favorite poems from this book of poems of mine. It's called Keeping Up with the Olmsteads. And this is for Frederick Law Olmsted, 1822 to 1903. I chose this one as well because my son Truman is a history buff, and it mentions the Lincoln administration and a little bit of American history. Keeping up with the Olmsteds, as you probably know, Frederick Law Olmsted designed, among many other things, Central Park in New York City. Great-great-grandfather, your parks punished us. I wanted to play in your Central Park, only two blocks from home, not learn from it. Lessons about ambition, industry, and dull humility. Great Aunt Mildred, the venerable family chronicler who once sat in your remarkable lap, never let us or our Upper West Side neighbors forget your incomparable feats. You were every object's lesson. In Aunt Mildred's hallway daguerreotype of you standing next to Grover Cleveland, pointing at the horizon you fashioned, one could almost see my family's brownstone. But I have become suspicious of you, ubiquitous ancestor. Why were you traveling through Georgia and Tennessee mid-century? Lincoln appointed you the U.S. Secretary General of Sanitation, which Sour Mildred reminded us upon our every return from chasing the blinded carriage horses and from the other noisy, grubby play in the playground that you conceived for us. But unsatisfied by Eastern dirt, you too craved frontiers, horses, a life of play. So you followed your eager century west. After the war, what did you discover in Nebraska, in Texas? What brave dreams were sparked in Chicago after the fire as you kicked the still smoldering embers, conceiving New York's history anew? Inscrutable as you were industrious, exemplar of a fading century, your boundless imagination reminds us all of our inadequacies. Yet, if Aunt Mildred were alive today, she'd allow for no such feeble prattle. There's some of you in him, she'd probably say, and some of him in you. And don't dare think that when you walk his park so close to home, he's not regarding you even more closely than I do, waiting to see what you'll do with all that Olmsted he left you. As if I needed this grand and distant designer Frederick Law as my watchful, urban superego. No, Mildred, prying specter, you're as dead as he is, though perhaps more insistent in your instruction. I celebrate him as I do his best work, finding comfort during a spring walk from my one-time home in replacing an errant garden stone, smiling at a girl who outruns her dad, and watching the swan alight on a pond, placed there to complement the nearby glen. Thank you. Thank you very much. It also makes me think about, with the Davis Arts Center, how this building is perpetually, or purposefully rather, situated here in this grand park, not far from the library, not far from the high school, not far from the Veterans Memorial Center, where one can see the Davis Shakespeare Ensemble perform. And so I think of this as one of our central parks. My next book was titled Where's Juki? And if you're wondering, there he is. He's on stage with me. Where's Juki is a book that my wife Kate and I wrote. It's my poems and her essays. And it talks about the joys and challenges of raising a kid with special needs. And a few other topics that I slipped in there, including Juki's siblings. His sister Geneva, who's now a 20-year-old sophomore at Beloit College, and his little brother Truman here in the front row, who had been born not long before the composition of this poem. It's called The Functional Family. And as I have so much of my functional family here, I thought I'd share this poem. It's divided into three parts for the three children. It starts part one, Questions from Geneva, age 8. APR refers to the American Poetry Review. Daddy, The new APR is here. Does it have any of my poems? Daddy, who is the protagonist of this story? What is the climax? Is that an obstacle? Do all the obstacles come from the antagonist? Could I have some cotton candy? What if bad guys stole my personality? Could we catch their getaway car? Could we crack their safes? Juki, you are unhelping me. Daddy, you are being unresponsible with your very own kids. Daddy, don't wake the Teletubbies. Don't disturb the Wiggles. Daddy, do you see a truck? Do you see a truck? Daddy, what if you wrote an entire poem using only my words? 2. Jackson, also known as Juki. We get many first invitations to dinners, but never seconds. One neighbor had wall-to-wall carpeting until Jackson came for a visit. One had no wax floors until Jackson taught him about wax. Behold, he said in his Juki way, I present to you 100 varieties of wax. Wine glass in hand, the husband led me from the playroom as Juki balanced atop the terrarium, reaching for the candles, thought to himself, should I? It's his house, I thought, and we'll be gone soon. Soon the floor was a variegation of wax. Behold the candle wax, ear wax, beeswax, and mix of wine and cheese wax. Jesse Jackson once said that America is not a blanket, one piece of unbroken cloth, the same color, the same texture, the same size. No, Jesse taught us that America is more like a quilt. Many pieces, many colors, many sizes, all woven and held together by a common thread. Finally, quiet in his crib, but never asleep, our Jackson has found that common thread, and he has pulled it hard. Behold our quilt now. The patterned symmetries are now scarred by acid rain. The heads of the ducks and the rabbits have been clear cut. This land is his land. That smog I smell has licked its tongue into the corners of our evenings. Jackson, your storms and hurricanes have leveled the shelf of picture books. Jackson, we still feel the effects of your tsunami. Thunder lizard, joy buzzer, wordless banshee, behold, it's Jackson. Part 3, Truman's section. Truman's section of the house he shares with the photo albums, the computer, the guest bed, the Jackson-free toys, all precious, all breakable. At 4 months, when not sleeping, this unsuspecting boy smiles broadly. He lives to catch our eye. At Geneva's show and tell, Truman is that which is shown. He could win a staring contest, said one boy. We stare and stare at this last child, the blue boots, the drool bib, the dragon jammies to which we have pinned our hopes. We are counting on you, tiny child. At 75th percentile weight, 90th percentile height, your size matches both siblings together at this age. Good for you, boy. Grow strong legs. For at times, you will need to run. Your hands now can palm a ping-pong ball. Soon that broad grip will block less gentle projectiles. Those soft shoulders, now so close to your ears, will broaden, strengthen, and calcify under loads we are thankful not to imagine.
Thank you.
All right, as Truman's here, I thought I'd read, I think the only poem that's totally devoted to him in Where's Juki. It's called Truman and the Seagulls. Truman and the Seagulls. 1,000 miles from any sea, seagulls swoop at the California boy in the sunglasses and Star Wars shirt. The boy who can't believe his good fortune to have found so many dance partners for this interspecies tarantella. The change in his pocket keeping time like a carnival tambourine. The gulls and the waves, the gulls and the waves and the robust wind. The lake's spray inhabits the boy. The 100 Chicago skyscrapers inhabit the boy. His inner ear hears the seagulls cry. He contains their frenetic heartbeats, their noisy airborne yearning. in his own heart. The gulls and the waves, the gulls and the waves and the robust wind. The gulls sing to him, and he chases them down in his dreams. Thank you. Kate was playing, my wife Kate was playing some Simon and Garfunkel this morning while getting ready for, maybe it was this afternoon, for today's event. And so I thought I would read a poem that is subtitled With Apologies to Simon and Garfunkel. This is also one of the rock and roll poems that I chose for James Lee Job to enjoy. It's called The Recruiting Station. This comes from my book, In the Almond Orchard. Whereas Where's Juki, this is the pitching part of the program, whereas Where's Juki raises money for the Smith-Lemley Opitz Foundation, which is a underfunded foundation for which Kate has been a volunteer communications director for many years, that funds research into Juki's rare syndrome. And so that's what happens with the money made from this book. This book is largely, we were talking about this in the car on the way here, a series of appropriations of stories of veterans who were returning to this part of California after serving overseas. And with this book, I'm funding a creativity prize in honor of my Uncle Chuck, who was a World War II veteran and a photographer. Some of his photographs are found in the book. And the creativity prize is for veteran students at UC Davis. So if I sell a few more, I'll have enough to fund the first year of the prize. It's going to be in the form of a gift certificate to the creative veteran, because if you give them money, it screws with their financial aid and does nobody any good. This poem is called The Recruiting Station, With Apologies to Simon and Garfunkel. Let us be soldiers. We'll invade some small countries together. I've got some armaments here in my bag. So we bought some hand grenades and meals ready to eat and walked off to look for the recruiting station. Martin, I said, as we boarded a Greyhound to Augusta, the Georgia Dome seems like a dream to me now. It took us 4 hours to hitchhike from Valdosta. I've come to look for the recruiting station. Laughing in the tank, playing games with the knobs and dials, Martin said the captain in fatigues was a Bolshevik. I said, be careful, he's friends with Boris Yeltsin. Toss me a needle, I keep an extra there in my holster. We used the last one an artery ago. So I looked at the barbed wire as Martin reviewed the field manual and the coordinates came in over the radio. Martin, I've lost my drone, I said, though I knew he was unconscious. I keep pulling the trigger and I don't know why. Counting the boys who used to play football in high school, they've all come to look for the recruiting station. All come to look for the recruiting station. All come to look for the recruiting station. Thank you. It's tricky to write a book of war veteran PTSD poems without too much revealing one's kind of progressive anti-war, anti-firearm politics, and yet still being respectful to the young men and women who have served our country this way overseas. When I read a poem before you all, I would choose a different one than the ones that I read when I'm asked to read at Memorial Day or Veterans Day ceremonies as Poet Laureate here in Davis, which are some of my more meaningful and poignant poetry events of any particular year. It's also strange, and let me say for the record that Frederick Law Olmsted was not my great-great-grandfather. It's also strange to try to inhabit people who are very different from you As I do on a regular basis, I studied T.S. Eliot and Robert Lowell, among others, for my doctoral dissertation. And they're both famous for writing poems from the point of view of other people other than themselves, and often even villainous dictators. And so you can decide for yourself the extent to which any of these are autobiographical. Kate would say, no, not much. This poem is called Gifts and Prizes. It's in three parts. One, my father had taught me how to hunt, how to take apart and reassemble my hunting rifle, how to sit patiently, listening in a duck blind. He could walk the forest silently, like a deer that itself fears the hunter. Cancer had been stalking my father. When it pounced, it left me alone with my rifle, impatient for targets. Two. The recruiter told me that my father taught me a translatable skill. The recruiters had translators to talk to my friends from the neighborhood, American-born braceros who sat with me at lunchtime, telling aspirational war stories in broken English. If ever I didn't understand, Pedro would yell, "Come on!" Then, as urgent as a pistolero drill instructor, he would tell me to drop for 20. And then he himself would drop, keeping pace in the chalky dirt. Three. At my father's side, I first shot mounds of unmoving earth. I graduated to paper and stayed there too long, wounding concentric circles for years of puberty before I was ever allowed to see my first duck, a fat mallard with sad eyes. I've won prizes at the fair and lost hours in the arcade. By now, I have shot more paper than ducks and more people than paper. Four. Blessed be the held breath that steadies the hand. Blessed be the patient heart slowing to a crawl as one aims. Blessed be the eyes that frame the shot, that narrow to see both more and less. Blessed be the target that does its part and drops. Thank you very much. I'm on the track, I hope, to come out with a book every year now, in some genre or another, for the rest of my life. That's my plan, a book a year. And if people don't want to publish my books, I'll step in and take care of that. This is last year's book. This is last year's bonus book. It's called 25. I won't be reading you from the pub quiz book today, but it's there for your perusal. This one is called 25. Kate and I recently, in September, celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. And I was irresponsibly absent during many of my needed household and domestic chores in the month of August of this last year, largely because I was secretly writing an entire book of poetry for my wife, and then I handed it to her when we were out to dinner at a fancy restaurant on our 25th wedding anniversary.
And you're now officially forgiven.
Right, I'm sure. There are many more things I'm going to do for which this is going to come in handy. And so, and I was talking about audiences before. This is a book that has primarily just one audience, and much of it's none of your business. But as I was rereading it this morning and preparing for this event, it made me think, you know, some of these are pretty good. Like, this could be its own book. So we'll have to see what else I do with this book called 25. But although this is the point of the book right here, this particular image, this image might not be in the version that gets published by a yet-to-be-named independent, lucky independent press. Here's one called electricity. Electricity. Your north wind's insistent whisper insinuates. It directs my impatient weather vane. These birches will not bend even in this stiff wind. Inviting calisthenics, those lithesome edges, how far can they stretch? Place your palms again against my engulfing palms. Lift that gorgeous glimpse so I can see your beckon. Making faces in the deep dark, storm clouds seek to close this space between us. Discovering its voice, the wind is having fun with the bedroom curtains. The air rings with momentum. Somewhere, a barnyard door was left open. Spurred by your electricity, the colt wishes to meet the filly. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. I started at about 10 after. My degrees are in English, not math. It's 2:33. Just thinking out loud a little bit. Let's go to some new poems. My bulldog, Daffodil, we call her Dilly, co-stars in a lot of my poems, including this one that I wrote this last week and which will be new to everyone. It's almost new to me. Here's a note. A funambulist is a tightrope walker. That might be something you wouldn't know. And Falstaff comes in to the poem about three quarters of the way through. We have some English majors over here, so they're thinking Falstaffian thoughts, and they will have some context in a moment. This one is called Awakened by a Daffodil. My sleep was more naive than deep. Juki's familiar and intermittent yodel emerged from another part of the house, and the wooden living room blinds were all still open, meaning that any curious passerby could pause before a ground-level window to watch me sleep, a dull pastime, if inexpensive. My two lenses upon the world, my iPhone and my glasses, had been slipped shallowly beneath the couch, as if these two helpers, these enablers, these technological manacles were also napping. Tucked in like little creatures, couched beneath the couch, they would not be stepped upon without the sort of volition that was unlikely in a home so calm. It has not always been so. The optometrist knows me by name. That the languorous bulldog felt invited to slumber was always understood, and the location, such as one of the cushioned thrones on either story of her kingdom or this couch, her platform on which I was unconscious and prone, proximate. Asleep myself, I did not detect the ungainly leap that brought her to my outstretched and unsuspecting legs, nor the tender situating, careful steps between human ankles that led to the gradual application of her dense frame upon me. At some juncture, though, and perhaps it was her initial automatic snores, I became aware of a weight that was too resolute, too concentrated to be that of a sympathetic blanket. Coming to at dusk and wondering for a moment if it might have been dawn, I felt upon me the external presence of a deepening sleep that compensated like a counterweight for my own insensible waking. I wondered if I was dreaming. For how irreconcilable it would be to find such a weighty imp straddling my calves like a tightrope walker, a funambulist Falstaff. Beloved goblin, our bulldog, collector of genetic indispositions, your time left with us may be brief. But like the beloved of a Shakespeare sonnet, I have frozen you here at the moment that you have immobilized me, unable to continue sleeping with this new weight, this bulky burden, and yet unwilling to enter a waking world where such ballast, such noisy, congested, temporal ballast, cannot be achingly embraced. Thank you. All right. My favorite Juki moment was I have two favorites. One, I was reading in a winery over by Placerville, and Juki got up out of the audience and brought me an empty glass, of which there were many. And so while continuing the reading, I poured him some water and sent him back to his seat. At another time at the Sacramento Poetry Center, he brought me a full pitcher of orange juice and a cup so that I could do my parental waiter duties while still giving a poetry reading. Why not? Is that funny, Juki? Okay. When I do come out with a published version of this book, 25, and I'll have to think of a new title that'll be relevant to more than one person, I think I'm going to put this poem in there that I wrote this morning for my wife, Kate. Pardon me while I shift my gaze over to her and read this one. It's called Preferences for Moonlit Glances. And it uses the vocabulary word of a philtrum, which is a vertical groove between the base of the nose and the border of the upper lip. Preferences for moonlit glances. Your skin has been bathed in decades of my glances, secret and unsecret. Chances to read you again like a text, me propped and smiling on one elbow, my wry, blithe eyes wide at my good fortune, while your head descends eagerly towards taupe, Egyptian cotton, thread count 1200. All the baggage unpacked, the new day promises an amnesiac no disappointments, and the gardeners, mowers, have not yet announced their weekly visit. California Queen, at this hour, we will surprise no one but ourselves. Let the revelers revel. Evening glances suffer competition from devices, little screens that fragment our attentions like so many hand grenades. Armed with phones, we are our own insurgents, each of us hoping to complete our sentences. My favorites, the summer moonlit glances, silent praise in the scanty luminous flux. Behold, rather than hold your sleeping frame. I'm just beginning to see the light. Still unadjusted after 25 years, my eyes eye the luster of your philtrum, the uncovered shoulder that, after an hour, shifts slightly towards the unblinking stars. I wrote that this morning. People love to share their new poems because they can't yet tell how much more revision they need, right? Because you're just so excited about your new poem. That will be true of this one, with which I will end. Connie Post, I was learning a few minutes ago, is an expert on how one comes down from prednisone and what happens to people who come down from it too quickly. I never knew that this was a thing. I am not what you call a drug taker. However, a really nasty case of poison oak a couple weeks ago sent me to urgent care, and I just nodded when they told me what they were going to put me on and for what purpose. And then Kate has helpfully pointed out that I wasn't quite myself when I was on prednisone. And we talked about some of the ways that that manifested itself. So I tried to channel some of that with this poem. It's called Prednisone, and I will end with this one. Prednisone. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for prednisone. Yes, it's prednisone, that oral steroid and immunosuppressant that cures whatever ails you. When I told my doctor, himself a former Marine, that I was feeling a bit off, as if I had been topped off, actually filled to the brim or beyond the brim, when I told him that because of the prednisone, maybe I was roided up like this street damnable villain in an action movie, When I told him all this, I could tell that he was taken aback, like he actually moved his chair backwards. He reminded me that prednisone differs significantly from the anabolic steroids taken by professional wrestlers, weekend weightlifters, and high school linebackers with muscle dysphoria. This drug prednisone is a horse of a different color. I asked him, is it a rainbow horse? Let's saddle up. Tell me more about the side effects, doctor. Talk me through my feelings. Be my therapist. Earn my copay. Prednisone, it's a corticosteroid, perfect for conditions such as arthritis, blood disorders, breathing problems, severe allergies, skin diseases, eye troubles, and immune system disorders. I wondered, how could one drug be perfect for so many different troubles? Medical science seems to be dumbing down the standards for perfection. Even more fun than the disorders would be the side effects. These included weakness, weight loss, nausea, muscle pain, headaches, tiredness, and dizziness. Ha! Where do I sign? Not typically a drug user, once too tough for Tylenol, and unaccustomed, for example, to caffeine, my body responds to medications atypically and intensely. I wanted to tell the good doctor that I was a special case, a sensitive poet, if you will. At least I was sensitive before the prednisone. Weight loss? Yes. I finally dropped down to 160 pounds this week. Training weight, fighting weight, but otherwise, the side effects don't apply. I am feeling strong rather than weak, awake rather than tired, and tightrope sharp rather than dizzy. Someone bring me a tightrope. What could go wrong? I'm on prednisone. Boy, you look nice this evening. Speaking of wrestlers, I will just move this couch for you by myself with my remaining good arm. That's okay. I don't need help carrying in these 12 bags of groceries, for I am insensible to the many ways that the plastic twiny handles cut red canyons into my poison oak hands, my ragged claws. I think we deserve a song at this juncture. Nobody asked me to scat right now, but that won't stop me. Brace yourself for my fricatives, plosives, and open vowels. Anticipate my arpeggios as they inform the melodic lines like a blooming calla lily, each petal a riff, you know, a rough, the good stuff, the sniffed snuff. This is the good stuff. Come on, come on, help me do. I've been feeding the rhythm. Help me feed the rhythm. The aging bulldog stops on each stair, but is nevertheless eager to ascend to the second floor where her mistress awaits. Every household should have a Queen of Sheba. Wishing to encourage the bulldog, I skip up the stairs next to her and then run back down. I take the stairs two at a time next to her and then run back down. She's almost there. I take steps three at a time. Cassius says that Caesar doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, but nobody speaks of jealous Cassius today. Meanwhile, the bulldog is still climbing. Hey, bulldog, some kind of innocence is measured out in years, and you don't know what it's like to listen to your fears. I commend you for your effort, dear bulldog, but my new friend prednisone and I beat you to the top of the stairs. Knock, knock. Thank you.
Andy Jones, one more time. Come on.
I, too, have had my experiences with prednisone, and some of the side effects, like one of them includes loose skin. And like, yeah, give me some of that. I want some of that. At one point, I was in the hospital, My asthma was massively bad. I had pneumonia. I had an oxygen mask on, and I had like intravenous drugs in one arm, and this like electronic thing to measure my oxygen level on the other side. And the doctor comes in and he says, "We're going to give you prednisone, massive amounts of it. It's a steroid." And I said, "It's not going to mess up my sex life, is it?" Anyway, oh, by the way, Dilly, you've got to follow Andy on Instagram and Facebook, social media, so you get the Dilly photographs. Kate, too. You need the Dilly photographs. This is one cute little, this is a cute dog. I like the one where it's like in the thing in the blanket in the chair. Oh, that was sweet. Okay, well, Andy Jones is not the only poet laureate here today. We have a poet laureate emeritus from Livermore. And Andy, you've done 4 years, right?
3.5.
Kate also did 4 years, and they were 2005 to 2009. Her work has appeared in many journals. I'll name a few here. Comstock Review, they've rejected me. Cold Mountain Review, Slipstream, they've rejected me. River Styx, and many, many others. She's written 7 books of poetry. Floodwater won the Lyrebird Award, and she has many other awards, too. Please welcome my friend, Connie.
Thanks for all for coming today. Before I forget my prednisone thought, in my house we call it prednicate crazy, and I have asthma too, so I'm like, I'm going on prednisone again, build a bunker. So anyways, it's really my great pleasure here to help kick off this venue, and also, is this, like covering my face, or should I be?